Hello, everyone. I'm Patrick Sanders of U.S. News and World Report. On behalf of Cebu, welcome to today's teletraining session on writing for and reaching a millennial audience. Our moderator today is Alex Heath. Alex is a senior reporter for Cheddar, where he regularly breaks news on the biggest players in consumer tech and media. Before Cheddar, he was a senior reporter for Business Insider, and he was the 2018 recipient of the Larry Berger Young Journalist Award from Cebu. Joining us on the panel today is Jennifer Benz. She is a principal research scientist and deputy director of the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research, which collaborated with the American Press Institute on a nationwide survey and study of the news habits of millennials. Dr. Benz has her PhD in political science from the University of North Carolina. Also on the panel is Susanna Snyder. Susanna is the senior editor for personal finance at U.S. News and World Report. She covers a range of personal finance topics from taxes to college financial aid and budgeting strategies. She is the recipient of the 2018 RTDNA NEFI Excellence in Personal Finance Reporting Award in the digital category. She holds her master's degree in journalism from the University of Southern California. And finally, Jerry Spratt is here. Jerry is the director of content at NerdWallet, which is a great personal finance website. He joined the San Francisco-based startup in 2014 after a 16-year career in traditional journalism. And in that short period of time, NerdWallet has built an in-house team of more than 70 writers and editors covering all aspects of personal finance from a consumer-facing perspective. Before we jump in, just one note to our listeners. If you have a question for the panel, please email it to sabew@sabew.org. That's sabew@sabew.org. The questions will be forwarded to Alex, our moderator. He will present them to the panel. Once again, the email address is sabew@sabew.org. And with that, I'll turn things over to Alex and the panel. Alex.
Thanks so much. Hey, everyone. Super excited to have this conversation. We're going to talk about millennials and the news, how they get the news, how we write for a millennial audience, which is really quite a large audience, spanning all kinds of people groups, but a lot to dive into. I want to reiterate from the top, please do send in questions to sabew@sabew.org, and I will be looking at those, and we will get into those here throughout this next hour. First, I want to just have everyone here on the call with me introduce themselves, talk a little bit about their work and how they are thinking about this topic, and then we can jump into more specific questions. Jenny, why don't we start with you, and especially given all the research you've done on this topic, I'm really curious to hear your perspective and what you're kind of seeing at a high level here. Thanks so much.
Sure, thank you, and thanks to Cebu for having me. I'm really excited to be a part of the discussion today. So I can talk a little bit about the research and give a little background. So in 2014, the AP NORC Center for Public Affairs Research partnered with the American Press Institute with a long-term endeavor of better understanding news audiences broadly. Our joint partnership is called the Media Insight Project, and the first study that we conducted was called the Personal News Cycle, and the main goal of that study was really to update the way that we measure news consumption and news attitudes and behaviors in surveys. And so we developed a set of measures that are more sensitive to the modern news environment and measure how people follow news stories across time and media platforms from, you know, where they first hear about a story all the way until they're seeking more information about it in the days and hours afterwards. So when we conducted this study and we were looking at the data by age, we saw hints and signals in there that the sort of popular narrative about the millennial generation being disinterested in news and vast differences in their willingness to pay for news and follow news compared to older generations in the pre-digital age. We saw signals that that was likely overstated when you actually are able to measure news consumptions in different ways. So the next year, we set out to do an in-depth study specifically of the millennial generation. So at the time, it was in 2015, those 18 to 34 years old. And we looked really closely at how these young people learn about the world on different devices and platforms. And we found that, you know, millennials are anything but newsless, as they were being called, passive or civically uninterested. And we saw that they do consume news and information in very different ways than older generations, and that their paths to discovering news are a bit more nuanced and varied. And we can talk about some of the sort of broad strokes of those findings during the discussion today. But one thing that we really focused on is that we didn't want to treat the entire generation as a monolith and assume that everybody in that whole, you know, generation does everything the same way when it comes to their news behaviors. And so we also use that data to profile millennials and break them down into we uncovered four different typologies. And we found at a pretty high level that millennials, in terms of their news consumption, generally break out with key differences in their attitudes and their behaviors depending on whether they're younger or older millennials, and some millennials have grown up in an entirely digital and mobile world, and others were sort of on the breaking edge of that trend. And we also found that they differ pretty significantly as to whether they're kind of active news consumers or they are more passive news consumers who bump into news throughout the course of their otherwise digital life. I think all of the four different typologies we uncovered in the data have really important implications for publishers, and I'm happy to go into any of the specifics of our research as we take questions.
Great. So, Susanna, let's go to you next. So working at U.S. News and World Report, covering personal finance and that range of stuff, what are you seeing with the millennial audience, and then just really how do you think about that demographic as a whole when it relates to news consumption?
Yes. First, thanks to Sabu for having me on this call as well. So just to refresh, I work as a senior personal finance editor at U.S. News and World Report, and we report on a variety of personal finance topics on that beat, including, you know, budgeting, taxes, saving, debt, family finance, all sorts of things. So millennials make up about half of our readership on the personal finance beat, and I see our content as kind of a natural fit for millennials. We're providing actionable advice and financial tips on topics like home buying or debt payoff, paying taxes. And so these are topics that millennials are really interested in and that they don't always have a professional source like, say, a financial advisor or a CPA to advise them on. So when I'm approaching writing for millennials on my beat, I kind of think about three things. The first thing is that millennials aren't all 22 anymore. You know, they're not all the stories about them wanting participation trophies and, you know, needing nap rooms in their offices and all of that, I think, is at this point very passé and was maybe always kind of unwarranted. So we really are targeting them when we're writing about serious and complex financial issues like taxes, like home buying, like boosting your retirement contributions. These are things that millennials who can be, you know, in their mid-30s really are interested in and are looking for unbiased, reliable, well-researched advice in. So, you know, that's one thing I kind of think about just to start off. The second thing is when we're writing for millennials, I try not to be afraid to have my own writing and the writing of our contributors be too basic. So it doesn't mean condescending, but just spelling out, like, for example, if you're writing about the standard deduction, what is the standard deduction? What does it mean? What does it apply to? Just really assuming when people come to our stories that they're coming from a level of financial knowledge where they don't want the writer to assume that they already know a lot, but they really want basic questions answered, I think can sometimes be tough to do from a writer standpoint, especially when you're writing about these things day in and day out, but is really, really helpful. So always having that basic and objective, reliable information. And then the third thing I think about is just the fact that millennial readers are not coming necessarily to our content from our homepage. So they're getting to us from Google or from social media or from podcasts or from other sources. So how do we make sure our content works from that perspective and is locatable, you know, on something like a search platform like Google or on a social media platform? So those are the three kind of facts I try to keep in mind as I report and assign stories to our outside contributors. But yeah, the bottom line is I think personal finance especially is just a really natural fit for millennial readers.
Absolutely. All right, Jerry, we'll go to you next. So NerdWallet obviously also very heavily into covering personal finance, really what you all are known for. How do you approach and your team approach the millennial audience versus other audiences? And also just please, fill us in on what NerdWallet is up to. Thanks so much.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for having me on the panel. I really appreciate it. This is an interesting question for me because having spent 16 years at newspapers, San Francisco Chronicle and Seattle PI, rest in peace, we didn't really think very deeply about how to reach segments of our audience in an effective way. And then going to NerdWallet in 2014 completely flipped that whole framework for me and for the rest of the leadership team at NerdWallet. And what we've really done is we've taken an opportunity to build an in-house team in a strategic way where we have our intended readership is reflected in our staff. And what I mean by that is not only do we have a large segment of millennials on a 70-plus person team, but we've also made sure that we have people in every time zone, in every major metro. Our team is completely distributed. So I think what that has done is it's built in some empathy on our team to the readers that we are trying to engage. All that said, NerdWallet is not a traditional media outlet. We don't consider ourselves to be a news publication. We do have mostly former traditional journalists on our team, and we do write we have an editorial integrity statement on it on every page that is created by our content team. But we recognize that we are attached to a business in a way that a lot of other publications are not. So there's a few different challenges and a lot of ways that makes our jobs a little easier because we are very focused on readers who have a problem right now. I think Jenny used the phrase active news consumers versus passive. Most of our users are active because they have a question like, how do I refinance my student loans? And so our whole strategy is to be there when that question pops into their head and comes out of their fingers and goes into Google. And we've been very effective at that. But there's only so much you can build from a strong SEO strategy, which is essentially what that is. When you're trying to engage an audience that maybe only needs to ask that question once every 3 years. If they find NerdWallet, great, but what about the other two years, 11 months? So what we've done since then, since we built out our SEO strategy is sort of sat down. We've had several brainstorming sessions, like how do you build some recognition among this audience that only needs you occasionally, but when they do need you, they really do need you. How do you achieve sort of this ubiquity where when people hear the name NerdWallet, they know what that means. It either triggers a feeling of trust or it triggers a feeling of credibility or whatever that is. So one of the things that we've done is we've actively sought out partnerships with media outlets. We've gone to them with a very strong pitch that says, yes, we are a business. We do make money in a different way than, we don't have display ads on our site. But the product that we're producing is as credible as any other journalism outlet out there, and here's the proof. And then, we can demonstrate not only who's on our staff, but also show a pretty strong body of work that we've actually got, I think we're at like 36 or 37 media partnerships right now. Some of those are generalist sites where, you know, we're engaging a very large audience that's maybe lower intent. But some of them are a little more niche where we know, like, that's where our target audience is. That's where they're going to consume news actively. And that's where we can start to build trust. And maybe they do stumble across us when they do have a problem on a partner site and end up at nerdwallet.com. So what we do with as much information as we can gather from all that traffic coming in is we start to research what kind of reading experiences do millennials want on NerdWallet. We know enough about the behavior on our site to say this format works, this doesn't. Short, digestible, step-by-step stories work better than long, you know, fully contextualized stories about, say, student loan debt. So we're able to optimize our content, which is a luxury I never had in traditional news. We have a large evergreen library that we are constantly updating and optimizing and changing because we have data that shows us how readers are navigating through our site, how long they're staying on a story, how likely they are to click to the next step of whatever it is they're doing. So I think, I mean, the last point I'll make, I think this is another thing that Jenny touched on as well. What we've learned with all that is that treating millennials as a monolithic audience is a huge mistake. I think it's a huge mistake that the news industry has made. I think it's a huge mistake that society at large has made. I work at a startup in San Francisco, so I've seen every cliche you can possibly imagine about the millennial audience. But then I live in Seattle, and I see a totally different demographic that still fits into that age group. So what we've done with our efforts to learn as much as we can about our users is figure out among the millennial audience, who are the ones that are most likely to want to use our website, who are most likely to come back, who are most likely to be willing to share some of the information about themselves so that we can help them make better decisions. So we've really narrowed what we consider our millennial audience down to a much smaller segment. That's sort of our bullseye that we're trying to go after all the time. And then as you miss the bullseye and you engage the audience around that bullseye, what we've seen is a huge growth in audience and traffic, and our business has been extremely healthy over the last 4 years because of that.
Great. Thanks, Jerry. I thought it was interesting how everyone kind of touched on misconceptions about millennials and treating them like a monolith was a recurring theme in what everyone just said. I do want to dive into that next. I do want to remind everyone we are starting to have some questions trickle in. Please do send those to Sabew@sabew.org. That's S-A-B-E-W. I'll be sure to read those here on the call, and we can get to those in a second. But yeah, I think it's important just to start by recognizing that millennials are not this monolithic group, right? I mean, I think right now in 2019, if you're between the age of 23 and 38, you're a millennial. That's a huge range, obviously. And I think maybe we could help by starting and talking a little bit about what we've seen as some of the bigger misconceptions, what those are around, I guess you could say, quote unquote, millennials. It's a word that gets thrown around a lot in headlines. And maybe Jenny, can we start with you and all the research you've done on this? And I know you'd mentioned that you all had kind of typed out four categories of millennials, within your research, but could you maybe touch on what some of those misconceptions are that you found through your research, and then we can go ahead and jump to whoever wants to jump in after that. Thanks.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think some of the common misperceptions that we came across, idea that, and I think, I can't remember off the top of my head who coined the phrase, but there was this phrase that was popping up in the sort of popular commentary around the news industry that the entire, you know, generation writ large was newsless. And we found that to be, far from the truth, and saw, you know, that about 70% of millennials say that they are, you know, getting news at least once a day. You know, looking at the generation overall, you know, 40% of those of the generation were saying, you know, that they're going out on a daily basis and actively seeking out the news. And, you know, the other 60% of these consumers were saying that they kind of stumble upon the news as they go about the course of their other activities every day. You know, we also saw that millennials definitely use a mix of platforms and paths to getting their news, but that doesn't mean that they've also, you know, that they've completely put aside legacy media or traditional forms, traditional platforms either, and that there were still, you know, sizable segments who rely first and foremost on their newspaper, no matter what device they or platform they may use to get that information. And we even found that 40% report that they are, you know, that subscribe or at least regularly paying for some sort of news content. So it's not another misconception out there was that they're just everything's supposed to be free online and they're unwilling to support the industry. And we didn't see, you know, complete evidence of that conception either. In terms of sort of breaking the generation down even further and trying to think about these different groups, I mean, I think, you know, one thing we definitely see in the data is that younger millennials are still forming their news habits and that there are lots of opportunities out there for publishers to be able, you know, to be a part of that process. They're, you know, they're learning how they want to get information, what information they need, and how to find it. And so, you know, there's definitely an active strategy for publishers in reaching the younger cohort of millennials. And, you know, as millennials are now aging up and developing their own news habits, you know, the younger cohort of the future generation, I'm not sure that we've decided what we're calling them yet, but the next generation after millennials are now
Gen
at that
Z,
point.
I guess.
Right, exactly. Yeah. trying to figure out, you know, how their what their news habits are going to look like. But, you know, we see that roughly a quarter of millennials sort of fall into the type of news consumer, you know, that NerdWallet was, you know, initially seeing in terms of their own site, which are, you know, these people who are a little bit older and they're very actively going out and trying to find the news that they're looking for and to be informed. And then everybody else, you know, the rest of the generation sort of fell into these other camps of either being, you know, interested and engaged in the news, but still trying to figure out what their habits are and are therefore still pliable and able to be reached by different types of publishers. Or there are people that are maybe less interested in the news, young or old, but that doesn't mean that they're not news consumers, and they, you know, they're definitely going out there and seeking information, you know, that's useful and needed for their lives, and still definitely a reachable audience, but one that is less likely to go to your homepage on a day-to-day basis just to check in and see what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. What about you, Susanna? Are there any misconceptions that you've seen either in your role or personally or anecdotally around millennials and how they consume news?
Absolutely. You know, as I mentioned a little earlier, the kind of cliche about millennials sort of wanting participation trophies and maybe being in when they have financial questions or financial problems, it's sort of, I think there's maybe a lack of sympathy or just a lack of understanding into why maybe they have high student loan debt or why they're struggling to live in very expensive cities. And so really writing about these issues in a way that is non-judgmental and then is also gives, you know, again, actionable, reliable advice is huge. So, you know, when I'm thinking about writing content for millennials, there's certainly a range of lifestyle and life stage issues, excuse me, that you can write about. So everything from paying off student loans to starting a family or buying a first home. And then I actually think there are topics that people don't think are millennial focused. So say tax filing topics that still really appeal to a millennial readership because oftentimes these younger people are maybe filing taxes without a CPA. or trying to just survive in an economy that's more and more do-it-yourself. So again, yeah, just understanding that there's a range of financial questions and financial issues that millennials are dealing with, and it's not all kind of this approach of like, oh, you're fresh out of college and you don't understand anything. But I think some articles take that tone. So really understanding the nuance of that, I think, has been helpful.
Gary, what about you and NerdWallet, misconceptions around millennial audiences?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it's been touched on, but the way that we sort of think about it is, yeah, the millennial, the age range is so huge that to try to approach the audience in any way that you think is going to engage even half of it effectively is a mistake. I think some of the misconceptions about millennials that I think we've all heard, you know, that they prefer experiences over things. They like everything to be, you know, easily understood, probably lives on their phone in some way. You know, they want their bank on their phone. They want to get their news on their phone. All of those things, of course, are true to a certain extent. But I think maybe Susanna mentioned this. I think it's important to think about the millennial audience as several different stages of life. And when maybe right out of college, maybe you're not so much engaged in topics that might be a little dry, you know, personal finance topics. But as you age up and as you start making those bigger life decisions, you're much more likely to be engaged and be interested in some of the topics that all the people on this call deal with on a daily basis. So when we really think about our audience, we assume a certain level of engagement and income, because that's part of part of how we're able to essentially do business. But we're also thinking about where are these people in their decision making, and I think there is a misconception about millennials that, you know, they prefer to rent over buying a home. They do prefer to live in large metropolitan areas. Yes, again, those stereotypes do ring true sometimes, but for the most part, a lot of our users are not, they don't fit into those buckets. They are people who are maybe in their early 30s and starting to think about buying their first home, or have just had a child. And the level of self-responsibility and awareness in that audience is much higher than the younger, like 23 to 27 audience. And those are the people that we know are seeking us out and are finding us. And the more effectively we can do that, the more effectively we can set the table for that next group in the lower end of the cohort to come through. We'll be able to serve that audience more effectively than we can serve our audience today.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to kind of move now in towards distribution, the social platforms, paid versus ad model. This does get into one of our listener questions. Someone asked, how do you manage in an age when social media platforms like Facebook deliberately downplay news? I guess that's a Facebook specific one. So I want to get to that. I think when we're setting up, you know, as everyone has kind of touched on, with just how wide of a generation the millennial generation is, I mean, the one common thing I think that kind of unites the generation is that it really is the first generation to grow up with the internet, right? And as someone who personally is kind of towards the middle of that age range, I'm thinking just personally how it's affected my behavior of how I find news. And I either, like Jerry, like you were just saying, I either know exactly what I want to find and I Google it, and I have an exact kind of, it's like going to Amazon to get something. And that's a very specific behavior and requires, you know, a specific mindset from the publisher's perspective. Or I kind of expect to find me. And that usually falls into one or the other. And the latter being usually through social, whether that's Twitter or Facebook or Snap or whatever. So those are two very different behaviors, but I'm curious, maybe we can just start with Facebook, and then if you guys have thoughts on social media in general, how do you reach audience, audience with a capital A, not just millennial, but definitely also millennials, in the internet age when it is much more about how you can just kind of reach people or stumble into people's, you know, phone screen as they're often looking at something else. Jay, do you want to start?
Sure. I think that, we definitely see in the the data, at least when it comes to paying for news, that the social, and when we say social, you know, we saw in 2015, at least, at the time that, you know, Facebook was still the dominant social source for news in that generation. Instagram was quickly climbing the ranks at the time. But, I mean, even people who were saying that they get their news on social, that population is not, you know, entirely separate from the paying population of millennials. And so, you know, we saw overall that 40% of millennials pay for some sort of news product. That number quickly climbs with age. Very few, you know, young college-age millennials, 18 to 21, are paying for news. But once they're sort of a little bit more established or out of college and out in the world, the number starts to click up. And we see that that paying behavior is highly correlated with your attitudes toward the news, and how, you know, how important you think news is, both for your own life and sort of, you know, as a function of our democracy. But even those people, those young millennials who pay for the news, they're still most likely and still frequently get their information online through search, through social. So it's not that they're separate populations. It's just that the among millennials, you know, it's these especially active and newsy consumers are the ones who are both most likely to pay for something and the ones most likely to seek out content online.
Okay. Susanna, what about you? How do you think at U.S. News and World Report, how do you think about social distribution, particularly Facebook, and how that interacts with the millennial audience?
Sure. So we certainly have, you know, a social team and a social strategy and, you know, work to optimize stories for platforms like Facebook, you know, make sure they have headlines that work and images that work. This isn't necessarily a millennial-focused play. I guess this is sort of content across the board. But, of course, you know, younger audiences tend to find their content through things other than our homepage. So, you know, we think a lot about Facebook and Twitter and actually Flipboard, other social media platforms, SEO, you know, just diversifying our strategy. So SEO is also a huge part of how we're reaching out to readers. So making sure, I think, that we're not just putting all of our eggs into, like, the Facebook basket has been huge. But, yeah, I mean, millennials are digital natives. They've sort of, many of them have come of age maybe almost always having read their news online and always having seen news on some kind of social media platform. So, and I think they're really savvy about what looks reliable and what looks good and what looks sort of suspicious. So, you know, making sure, of course, when we put our content out on social media, making sure it really works for those individual platforms, of course, is helpful as well.
Yeah. Jerry, I know you mentioned NerdWallet likes to partner with media organizations. Obviously, you guys have been diversifying your approach. But how do you think about social in general and Facebook specifically here, as we've been talking about?
Yeah, I mean, social has been a challenge since I joined NerdWallet. I think the biggest challenge is just sort of it's subject matter related. It's hard to engage an audience that is scrolling through their Facebook feed or through a Twitter feed with a personal finance related headline. But at the same time, we understand that we kind of have to be everywhere, but we also need to figure out, like, where can we actually be effective? So, you know, Facebook obviously in many ways remains king. Instagram, I think, is catching up. But what we've realized on Facebook is, as much as this might be a negative overall, what Facebook does provide is the ability to target audiences very, very specifically. So, you know, internally we've figured out, like, what kind of photos work on Facebook, what kind of headlines work on Facebook, and then what are, you know, then we had to develop some in-house metrics to decide, you know, what is working and what is not, and how can we do more of what's working and less of what's not. But then the flip side to all that is you can get very scientific and analytical on a single platform like Facebook, but you can't transplant that strategy to Instagram. Say Instagram, we know, you know, people who are going to engage with us on Instagram are probably sort of aspirational, looking for some, you know, some image is obviously the first selling point on Instagram that stirs some kind of emotion in them that they would actually stop long enough to even realize it's a post from NerdWallet. So we're taking a different strategy, a different tack on Instagram than we are on Facebook, because it is a totally different experience, and it's on your phone exclusively. So that's slightly different. And then I think that another piece of this question is, how do we think about distributing news on social platforms? Our ability to compete in the news space is pretty slim because of the nature of what we do. But we do recognize very specific opportunities, like you know, if the, to use an obvious one, you know, when the tax code changed, being able to write the story about you know, if you're 32 years old and you want to know what the new tax code means for you, click here. That's a very slim use case, but it's one that we are constantly on the lookout for, because that's going to work on social. I think that's going to work on social. You know, Twitter is so much noise on Twitter. It's really hard to say. So that's one of the places where we know we have to be, but we don't necessarily try too hard to optimize there. And then I think the last one, that is really interesting and has actually delivered outsized results that if you asked me to predict a few years ago, I wouldn't have been able to point it out as an opportunity, is Flipboard and Apple News. Tons and tons of traffic come to NerdWallet from those two platforms. It's very low intent. Like they get to the site, they kind of read something and they leave. But it has been very eye-opening to realize that these two platforms that kind of fly under the radar of the daily conversation around social media are actually more effective in the space that we're trying to compete in than, you know, many of the other platforms where we're probably spending more money. So it's been pretty interesting to see the upward trajectory of traffic coming from those platforms, and then trying to solve the problem of, okay, we're getting all this traffic, but what can we do with it? Because it's not necessarily the traffic that's going to come and become a member at NerdWallet or transact at NerdWallet. So that's sort of an ongoing dilemma that we're dealing with right now.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm fascinated by the rise in subscriptions and especially just paid news as a whole versus the ad model. Jenny, I know you'd mentioned in your research you all had uncovered that what something like 40% of millennials either do or say they would pay for news, and that continues to track up the older someone gets. I'm curious to hear from all of you what you make of, it seems like it's kind of in vogue right now. Everyone is putting up a paywall. I think a lot of people are just realizing that the display ad model is not scalable and it's not able to provide a quality business to support good journalism. But Jenny, maybe you can start and kind of talk about what you're seeing from a trends perspective with the ad model versus subscription in news. Is that a millennial thing? Is that something bigger than the fact that we're in a new dominant generation? You know, what is going on there, and do you see that continuing?
Sure, yeah. I mean, you know, we see in the data, there's among the millennial generation, there seems to be sort of an overall comfort with a subscription model, not just in news. It's just something that they are, you know, whether it's their music or their video games or their movies, subscription models are something that they are familiar with. I think that we have done a few studies that are of, you know, all adults, not just millennials, but we did some work a couple years ago where we were able to obtain samples of people that had recently subscribed within the past couple of months to a newspaper, and we tried to sort of track their path to becoming a paid subscriber. And there's a lot of different factors that sort of go into the background of making that decision, but we also tried to, as much as we could, sort of focus in on what the trigger was for actually, you know, making the call at that moment to pull the credit card out of the wallet. And it was more often promotions and free trials than it was hitting up against a paywall limit. That was especially true for younger subscribers, and I don't know, it's just conjecture, if that's because younger, more internet-savvy subscribers are able to navigate around the paywall or figure out a way to get the information they need in some other fashion than older adults. But, you know, even looking at all adults generally, promotions and free trials, at least people tell us, are more likely to get them to take the credit card out than hitting a paywall.
Interesting. Susanna, what about you? What do you make of the rise in paid news versus ad-driven news?
I mean, that's certainly heartening to see that millennials are willing to pay for news. At U.S. News, we don't have a ton of paid products. We have our Compass platform, which is related to our college rankings on the college ranking side, which is paid and gives readers insight into some of the data that you can't get if you're not a paid subscriber. But on the personal finance side, so far there hasn't, at least on my team, hasn't been much of a move toward paid content. But you know, I think it's certainly interesting to see, and maybe there's, it points to maybe a desire to kind of cut through the noise and really choose publications and resources that you like and trust, and put, you know, some of your money and some of your time into focusing in on those. So, unfortunately, I don't have much to say about it from just the perspective of my team and my beat, but it's nice to see.
Jerry, what about you and NerdWallet? I know you said you guys don't run display ads. What do you think about the changing dynamics in the landscape where everyone is either A, throwing up a paywall, or doing some kind of membership program, or trying to have some kind of direct relationship with their readers?
Yeah, I mean, being untethered from the display ad model is probably the best macro development in my career. It's been sort of liberating in a lot of ways. But what we are seeing is, you know, with those partner sites that we are distributing content to, we're hearing about their struggle to figure out, you know, how do we take your content and optimize it for the most display ads possible, or do we pursue a new model that maybe is a paywall or some combination of the two? I'd say most of my conversations with editors at other publications makes me believe that the display ad model is not sustainable and it's not scalable, as you said. And a lot of publishers now are trying to get creative, because if they don't have the brand loyalty or the brand recognition of, say, a Washington Post or a New York Times or some big regional newspaper, throwing up a paywall can be sort of the end of that's the last tactic. And if it doesn't work, your business might be in trouble. So what we're seeing is a lot of our existing partners are coming to us and saying, hey, we see other personal finance companies that have content operations offering these other products to their partners, whether it's an affiliate model or, you know, some way that they're driving traffic to the site and getting paid for that. We don't have that, and we don't intend to, because I think the big concern for us is once we start trying to send business to or draw business from our partner sites, we're going to lose trust and credibility. People will see us as just trying to bait and switch. So I guess from the outside looking in, I don't see a great solution other than having a strong enough brand or product or loyal readership that the paywall model is something that is going to be sustainable. And I think what we're going to see is a continued consolidation of media outlets, some able to produce very high quality with a paywall model, with a subscription model, and the rest sort of being, as we've seen, consolidated into these large media holding companies with a diminishing quality, diminishing reach, and it's sort of two different trajectories that I don't really see a middle ground for anyone to play in eventually.
Yeah, I totally agree. We have about 15 minutes left. I do want to remind anyone listening to please send in questions we can try to get to in the remaining time that we have. That would be send those into to sabew@sabew.org. That's sabew.org. We do have one other listener question here to get to. This is kind of an interesting one. It's kind of a two-pronged question in a sense. This person asks, what is the business case for growing a millennial audience / younger readership? I hear some combo of, quote, we have to reach younger readers, unquote, with nothing more specific or no strategic goals behind it. Also, this person's hearing, quote, advertisers don't care about younger digital readers, unquote, which thwarts our efforts to invest in any audience growth strategy in any meaningful way. So there's kind of two parts to that. There's the, what is the business case, which, I mean, to me, at a gut glance, seems obvious, right? It's, this is, Jenny, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think millennials are the largest now generation in the U.S. Specifically in terms of population. I could be wrong there, but I'm sure they're getting close, if not. And then also, how do you reach them? How do you approach that from an audience growth strategy? We've kind of been touching along those lines throughout this whole conversation. But Jenny, do you want want to start and kind of give us a high picture of why a publisher should care about targeting and reaching the millennial audience?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're totally right. I mean, it's a sheer numbers argument in many cases in terms of the future audience and who your readers and listeners and subscribers are going to be over time in terms of why it should matter. And I mean, I think in terms of, you know, in engaging them, you know, similar to the way that we, you know, we sort of started the conversation and making sure that we're not talking about the interest and behaviors of this generation as a monolithic generation. I mean, I think the publishing strategy needs to follow suit, and that there's no, you know, single way to engage with this audience. I mean, you know, we definitely see, as we were just discussing, that social is dominant, and that doesn't mean that's, you know, that you're just getting people looking at free content on social. You know, again, we see that, you know, 2/3, give or take, of millennials are using Facebook multiple times a day and telling us that they're using Facebook multiple times a day and getting news while they're there. And then they also, if, you know, if we then drill down to those millennials who are willing to pay for news, many of them say that they discovered the news source they eventually paid for through that social interaction. We also see among millennials that there is a greater tendency to want to support the industry in terms of citing the reasons why they pay for news. They are likely to say that they, you know, they just feel like it's the right thing to do to support journalism. So, I mean, that's, you know, that's certainly an attitude and a behavior that is worth cultivating over time, especially when you then couple it with the fact that there's more millennials than there are of any other generation at the moment.
Yeah. Susanna, what do you make of that question, the two parts? I mean, it's essentially the business case and then the audience growth strategy and how those maybe interact. Have you, and throughout your career, have you gotten pushback from people on a business side of something saying, hey, we, you know, why should we care about this? Why should we be focusing on this? Or they don't, you know, it's hard to sell ads or whatever. I mean, what's been your you know, career experience with this, and then how are you approaching it now? That'd be great. Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, I certainly don't think it makes it, you know, it doesn't make business sense to ignore millennials. I don't think that's a great strategy. I mean, they're a large generation, and right now they're sort of coming to our content at points in their lives where they're making big financial decisions, you know, whether to refinance their student loans, whether to refinance their mortgage, asking questions about credit cards or how to buy a first home. So they're really coming to us at the point in decision making where I think they offer a lot of value to some kind of advertising or corporate partner. So to say that they're sort of that they don't have value, I think it's probably not correct. So, you know, again, I think you really have to think about some of the issues that millennials are dealing with right now. They're kind of high cost things, student loans, home buying. These are, you know, big business decisions and big personal finance decisions. And I think there is a lot of strategy that can be used to reach out to them and to make sure you're answering their questions so that they're coming to your site and seeing your content and seeing, you know, your advertisements or your partnerships instead of to somebody else's. So I hope that helps when they're making the argument to their higher ups that, hey, you know, this is an audience that we want to pay attention to.
Yeah. Jerry, thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think Susanna nailed it. I mean, the business case for us is that, you know, we're in the business of helping people find the solutions to their financial problems, and millennials are making those decisions right now. Obviously, there's a huge population of boomers. They have more money, but they've made all their decisions already, except for maybe some estate planning and retirement things that they haven't worked through yet. So for us, the millennial audience, regardless of their income today, is still going to be the most valuable audience we can engage, because they are, many of them have not made the large decisions that if they make it with NerdWallet, that helps us grow our business. So what we see is this, there's value to engaging the very young millennials who gradually start to learn who we are. And then when they get to those big life stage moments, we're there, and we're a product that they know how to use and they know they can trust. I think the big difference for me has been, you know, being at the San Francisco Chronicle and seeing the push-pull between the big, you know, the big money-making ads that were like Rolex and Nordstrom and things like that. They weren't targeted at all towards a younger millennial audience, but the newsroom was trying so hard to figure out how can we be relevant to this audience that we really want to, like, if we want to be a relevant brand in San Francisco, we need to be able to talk to all of these tech workers that you see going up and down Market Street every day. But at the same time, you know, we were beholden to a business that didn't necessarily allow us to go full bore on that audience. So being able to sort of step back and figure out, you know, what's the opportunity, and it's not, we don't have to sell ads. So the opportunity is to capture this audience now before they have gone and made all the big, you know, all the big transactions that they're going to make for the rest of their lives. By then we've sort of missed our opportunity.
Yeah. We only have about 5 minutes left, but a reoccurring theme I think we've had through this conversation is relevance and how do you stay relevant? How do you make yourself relevant to a generation? And maybe we can leave it there kind of at a high level. And again, I know we've touched on a lot of this, but maybe if each one of you could give your kind of high level thoughts on relevance and how you write in a relevant way for millennials, and how you're thinking about that in your day-to-day and in your research and even in your own content consumption, what is relevant? Because I think a lot of the, I guess, quote-unquote millennial content that's kind of now kind of made fun of, it kind of talked down to millennials, it seemed like, early on. I think a lot of publishers thought that was, the stuff about avocado toast and, like, all this stuff that has now kind of become like a little bit a part of meme culture, but I think people are realizing that you've got to actually, this is a gigantic demographic, and you can't engage that way. So, Jenny, maybe can you start here kind of for our last go around and talk about that relevance piece a little bit more. I don't know if you have any thoughts, but what you saw in your research from what resonated and what was relevant to that audience?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, we see that even among some of the less engaged millennial typologies that we found, you know, that they are still interested in hard news topics. They are definitely interested in topics that relate to finance and their career choices. And they may stumble upon that information or be looking for that information at, you know, less frequent intervals, or when there's a specific occasion that calls for them to find that news they can use. But they want the content. And we definitely, we think that in terms of reaching the majority of millennials who, may not be actively seeking content out on a day-to-day basis, is to make sure that, those accidental or random encounters that happen through social and through search, that those encounters are positive ones. And, we do see that, millennials are looking to engage, and that the ones who do eventually engage and pay for content are still getting their content through social. So, I think the strategy to consider is to think about different types of millennials, different ways to make those encounters a positive encounter. And certainly when we talk to millennials about the reasons that they eventually convert to becoming a payer or a subscriber, one of the key factors that they cite is the content itself being, useful and relevant to their lives. And so I think that's exactly right, that you want to avoid taking some of these misconceptions about the generation and letting those guide your content and publishing decisions.
Susanna, any last thoughts on relevance and how that relates to the millennial audience?
Yeah, absolutely. So, as you said before, I think millennials are thinking way more than about just like what kind of avocado toast to buy tomorrow. Like, this is a generation that's dealing with really interesting, fresh financial challenges. They're balancing student loans with retirement savings. They're trying to find affordable housing in high-cost cities like San Francisco or D.C. I mean, there's just, from an editorial standpoint, there's a wealth of things to write about and topics to pursue that are, I think, very nuanced and very relevant to a millennial audience. They also want to know, especially, as the election heats up, about how news is impacting their pocketbooks, what tax reform means for them, what deregulation or economic inequality means for them. So there's a ton to write about. As we put these pieces together, always keeping in mind how millennials are finding this content so that they might not be coming in or probably aren't coming in from our homepage, but also understanding their readership habits and that, social media, SEO, podcasts, all of these other resources are kind of a moving target, but trying to implement these as much into our strategy and our content as possible. So, yeah, those are my high-level thoughts on that.
Great, thank you. Jerry, last word.
Yeah, I mean, relevance for us is a slightly different recipe. It sounds pretty simple, but it takes a lot of work. We need to have a best-in-class user experience when people land on an article on our site, so that they get a good outcome. They either get the answer that they need, or they're directed to the place where they can get the thing that they need. And then we build trust with that user over time. And that's how we stay relevant, because we're not feeding the beast every day, as most news organizations are. We just need to be positioned for that person to find us when they need us. So for us, relevance is measured by, are people coming back? Are they getting the thing they need, and are they coming back, and do they trust us going forward?
Great. We're going to have to leave it there. Thanks so much to our three panelists, Jenny Benn, Susanna Snyder, and Jerry Spratt. This was a great conversation. Really appreciate it. Thanks.
Well, let me give my thanks to Jennifer and Susanna and Jerry, and also to Alex, our moderator, for a great discussion today. I think it was really informative. Thanks, everyone, for sharing with us. I really appreciate it. And I think our group does as well. I really hope that everyone is back with us next month for our next teletraining session. It is scheduled for 2 p.m. on Monday, June the 17th. The topic of that session will be covering the business of marijuana, so it should be a great discussion. On behalf of Cebu, thanks for joining us today. Everyone, have a great week.